Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news. The story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Christian civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guests. And this evening our guest is Pastor David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution. Now, David is a minister, but in addition to that, he works with the Institute trying to get people across America to understand the godly foundation of our nation. Did you ever wonder why America is different than any other nation in the world? Well, it's because we have a constitution that was founded upon a religious belief. Now, this does not mean that everybody who lives in our country has to be a Christian. You could be an atheist, or you could be a Muslim, or you could be a Hindu. But the whole idea of our society was based upon the Christian belief that we needed to have people who could govern themselves. If people can govern themselves, then they don't need an all-powerful government. And the whole idea was, if we had people who feared God, who were subservient to the Christian God and would follow his dictates as a whole, then we would not need an all-powerful government and men could be free. And so the basic foundation of this country was that our rights came from God. That's what it says in the Declaration of Independence. And it says that governments are instituted among men to preserve these rights, our God-given rights, deriving their just power from the consent of the governed. That's what America was about. That's why it was different. But our society was made only for moral and religious people, and it would not work for any other, said John Adams. And as you see what's happening in our society today, you begin to realize the wisdom of that idea. Well, David is telling us about the whole idea of the Bill of Rights. Remember, the purpose of the Bill of Rights was to restrict the power of the central government. That was the secret of America. We would restrict the power of government so men could be free. Unchain the government, and it will take away our freedom. With that as a background, Pastor David Whitney, thanks for being with us again.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be on your show, Dr. Stan, and to talk with people about these issues that are so vital, because our God-given rights are not secure at all, particularly in this day when we have ever-encroaching world government seeking to strip us, really, of all those rights. And I know that you and many of your other shows talk about some of the specific issues, the things that are taking place, bills that are passing and so forth, that are all stripping away what our Constitution was designed to protect, that is, our God-given rights, which is the sole purpose of government. And as our founder said, if government fails to do its God-given purpose, we have an additional God-given right, either to alter that form of government or to even abolish that form of government, which is what they wound up doing in the War for Independence there. They abolished their connection with Great Britain and established a new form of government. Ultimately, the experiment in the Articles of Confederation proved inadequate, and that's why they met to draft a constitution and then to see it ratified. But as we've talked about before, the 13 states, when they considered ratifying the constitution, there was one outcry that was loud and clear across the board, and that was, this constitution is not complete, it is not safe, it is not secure, because there is no Bill of Rights. Of course, this harked back to the Englishman's Bill of Rights of 1689. They knew that unless you have a Bill of Rights, your government may strip away all of your God-given rights.
And, of course, that is the problem, is that government always wants more power. Our founding fathers feared power. They realized that a government that could, you know, provide for you, had to be able to control you. They wanted men to be free to look after themselves, and never to have a federal government that could provide for you from the cradle to the grave. Well, David, go ahead, pick up the story.
So that Bill of Rights was proposed, and as it came through Congress, it was whittled down to 12, and ultimately only 10 of the 12 were ratified, and we've already spoken about the First Amendment, first in order and first in importance, because without religious freedom, you really have no freedom whatsoever. If you do not have the freedom to worship God as your conscience dictates, then any other claim to freedom is illusory. Now, next to the First Amendment, the Second Amendment comes in as second in importance, and that is the right of the people to keep and bear arms. As we discussed when we looked at this, it's not just so people can go out hunting and enjoy sports, skeet shooting, or things like that. No, it had to do with the final and ultimate check against government tyranny. That when tyrants take control, sometimes legally and judicially and every which way possible, they'll strip away all of your God-given rights, but you have one final defense, and that is ensconced in the Second Amendment. The right to keep and bear arms is what our colonists knew was the only way they had a recourse when Great Britain continued to act tyrannically toward them. The only recourse was to take up arms and defend themselves against the tyrannical government. And then we discussed just very briefly the Third Amendment, which really is rooted in the Englishman's God-given sense that a man's home is his castle. It doesn't matter whether it's a hovel or got holes in the roof. Nonetheless, it's his castle in the sense that the king cannot come barging in the door or come over the moat at any time he pleases. And the Third Amendment specifically dealing with the British practice of forcing private citizens to house soldiers in their homes, a particularly oppressive and very odious practice that the American colonists had their taste of, and enough of a taste to say, hey, we are not going to permit the new government to do this. And as you stated earlier, you get the sense as you walk along here through our Bill of Rights, each one of these Bill of Rights restricts the power of government. It says, thus far you may come and no farther. You do not have unlimited power. You do not have unlimited jurisdiction. And particularly for the federal government, read the Federalist Papers, such as Federalist 45, it's very clear that the federal government was supposed to be small and limited. It was to have very specified, delineated, enumerated powers, only those powers circumscribed by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. But the states were to have broad-ranging powers, and the design was that the states actually would be more powerful in many ways than the federal government.
Hold that thought right there, David. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly David is simply pointing out that if you read what our founding fathers wrote, and specifically the Federalist Papers and the 45th of the Federalist Papers, where they specified that the rights of the federal government were to be very limited in what they did, matters dealing with life, liberty, and property were to be taken care of at the state level, never by the federal government. Why? Because they feared the power of the central authority. If you got a corrupt state government, you can fight it, or you can move to another state. What do you do having a corrupt federal government? Well, unfortunately, there have always been those who lusted after power and control over the lives of the people, and knew the best way to do that was to begin to provide for them. Oh, we're so concerned about the people. Why, we're going to provide a pension for the very elderly so that we can help the elderly. Who could be against helping people? Oh, we're concerned about children. Now we've got to provide medical care for children. Well, this was always the function of the state and the local government, and believe me, before we began moving towards the fastest society, when I was growing up, nobody went without medical care in America because every community had a county hospital, and you could go there if you didn't have any money, if you could pay part of it, fine. The good doctors at that time went and contributed to take care, so that nobody went without medical care and nobody went without food, and there was always a poorhouse you could go and... Well, today, of course, we see the people sleeping under the bridges. That was never true. Before the federal government began to step in and say, we'll take responsibility for providing for the people. But you see, the whole idea is not to provide for the people. It's to make them dependent upon the government so the government can control them and keep dossiers on people. And, of course, today, in the name of fighting terrorism and incidentally, if there is really a terrorist threat, you would have think that Osama bin Laden could have at least got one more radical Islamist to sneak across our unguarded borders and commit a major act of terrorism here, but in over 5 years, it hasn't happened. So maybe this whole threat of terrorism is really being used to justify, little by little, and now massive step by massive step, taking away our freedom. Well, let's get back to David Whitney and this whole idea of the Bill of Rights and how it was to restrict the power of government so men could be free. David?
Yes, so when we shift from the Third Amendment to the Fourth Amendment, we actually make a turn and corner as to what this section of the Bill of Rights focuses on. The Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment, the Seventh and Eighth all deal with the criminal justice system. And specifically, from start to finish, the process of what will happen to you before you're charged, if you are charged with a crime, and then if you do have to appear in court, and if the result of appearing in court is that you do have to serve time in prison, all those steps are dealt with successively from the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th Amendment. So this whole section of the Bill of Rights deals with the criminal justice system. And the first way in which the criminal justice system will touch any citizen is what the Fourth Amendment is all about. You see, the Fourth Amendment prohibits the government from doing unreasonable searches and seizures, invading a person's private property, basically to try to find evidence against them that they have committed some crime or another. Fourth Amendment specifically reads, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by an oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Now, there's some very important phrases here that we need to understand. First, the key word, of course, is unreasonable. In other words, it doesn't say that no searches and no seizures are permissible. It just says unreasonable. This protects the citizen against searches and seizures which would violate what is reasonable. And the question, of course, is what do they mean by reasonable? Well, it's explained right there in the Fourth Amendment. To be reasonable, a search or a seizure must be accompanied by a warrant. What we commonly think of as a search warrant. Here, the police force has to go before a magistrate, before a judge, and they have to bring with them evidence in an affidavit setting forth that there is probable cause that the citizen has committed a crime. And so they have to have some evidence preceding it, not just, oh, we suspect, or he looks like a shady character, and so forth. No, they have to have evidence that would persuade a judge, and of course the judge, according to our founders, was supposed to be an independent party, detached and neutral, not siding with the police, but actually there to protect the citizens as well as to see that the criminals are dealt with. And unfortunately in our day, the judges have fallen down in their duty of protecting citizens in this regard, and oftentimes they'll rubber stamp warrants and so on that really don't have sufficient evidence that there is probable cause. But the Fourth Amendment is designed then to say, before the police can begin to do a search on your property or your person, they must have probable cause that will persuade an independent judge that that is the case, and he will sign a warrant. And now notice the description here of the warrant in the Fourth Amendment is very detailed. The warrant describes particularly the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. In other words, the warrant doesn't give them a license for a fishing expedition to ransack a house and search through everything there. No, it's very specific things that they're going to look at, a very specific place, and all of this is supposed to be specified in the warrant. And again, this is one of those principles that's very often violated. It's just throw the door of your house open and we're going to search everything. That's not the intent of our founders. That they wanted a very limited and restricted police powers, because they recognized that, and of course they recognized this from their own experience with tyrannical King George III, that if The police force is not restrained. If the civil government claims that, oh, in order to curb crime, we just have to lower all the rights of citizens and you just have to give up some of your rights in order to have security, and that's basically the kind of arguments that were taking place in the colonial era, and citizens were having their homes ransacked by the police at the behest of the civil government. They said, this is wrong. We know this is wrong. This, you are not guilty until proven innocent. And that idea is not just English common law. That is a biblical idea, that a person is not guilty until proven innocent. They're innocent until they are proven guilty by the judicial system. So the idea is here that the government has to have evidence even before they begin to search for evidence that you have committed a crime. And that evidence must be written down and persuasive enough that a judge would say, okay, I'll sign a search warrant that will permit the police to gather further evidence. But there's got to be probable cause that you have committed a crime. This principle today is being rampantly violated all over the country. One example I think of is the police checkpoints that are being set up on roadways all over our states. And they say, oh, these are sobriety checkpoints, you know. And we've got to pull over every single car, check their papers, check their license, and so on. And wait a minute, you're saying that every person here on this road, there's probable cause that they are committing a crime while they're driving down this road, in order that we therefore have to stop and search them, perhaps give them a breathalyzer, whatever it is that they're, or search their car. All of these things are a violation of the Fourth Amendment.
Well, I think, David, what they do is they're going to say, look, we may very well find somebody who's been drinking here who would be a menace to the road, and so in the name of helping people, why, this is what we're going to do, without realizing, of course, that, that you can almost justify anything you want to in the name of, well, we might be preventing a crime. Certainly, if we took the guns away from everybody in the country, why, we might prevent somebody from, you know, from killing somebody else. Or certainly with the whole idea of the Patriot Act. Well, you know, we've got to be able to search people's homes because they might be a terrorist. And so we've got to be able to go into their homes, the so-called sneak and peek attack. We'll go into their homes. We will not let them know we're getting their homes. We will not let them know that we can do this without a warrant. We can take things out of their homes, and, of course, we don't have to tell them about it. Maybe 2 or 3 months later, why, you know, we will tell them after we've indicted them that we've been into their homes and violated the sanctity of their homes. And see, this is you could justify that in the name of fighting terrorism, but, of course, once you do that, it's a very, very slippery slope towards the tyrannical regime that we're moving towards today, where they have a dossier on everyone. They can open everybody's mail. They can listen to their conversations with every cell phone has a little switch in it that they can turn on. You can't turn it off. And they can listen even when the cell phone is off. They can listen to your conversations. And the same thing is true with the telephones in your home. I mean, you may think that just because your phone is hung up, they can't listen to you, but they can. This is long-range planning so that they can watch everything you do because you might be a terrorist, or maybe you don't like this move towards the New World Order and the New World Religion. Go ahead, David.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the Patriot Act because that is a direct violation, both the First and then the reauthorized Patriot Act, which is even worse than the First Patriot Act, but both of them are a direct violation. Actually, they have gutted the Fourth Amendment, giving the government permission, finally on paper, as you mentioned before, that they've been doing this in the Clinton administration and before that with the Echelon program, listening to every phone conversation and searching people's mail and now people's email and cell phone conversations, and on the list goes. And they've given themselves permission illegally to violate the Constitution.
But, of course, they do that in the name of protecting us from the wicked Osama bin Laden, who's hiding in a cave somewhere over, of course, in Pakistan. But we've got to do this to protect you. We're from the government, and we're here to make sure that you're safe. And that's what President Bush says. You know, you elected me to protect you, and I'm going to protect you, even if it means gutting the Constitution. Of course, he doesn't believe in the Constitution. He's already said that. We'll be back in just a moment with Pastor David Whitney. The Constitution is our only protection of freedom. David, go ahead.
Well, the really egregious thing is that many people in our country believe that, oh, this is okay. We could permit the government to do this because, after all, they are protecting us. Our founders knew that no such thing is true. You see, they understood that human nature, the Bible says very clearly, that human nature is fallen, it's sinful. And any time you give unlimited power to anyone, that person is going to become corrupt, and that person is going to abuse the power that you entrust them with. And therefore, the only safety for your God-given rights is to have checks and balances on each power that is granted to each level of government and each branch of government. And so the enforcement power of the police has to be checked by the judiciary, and so that each branch is checking the other. And all these things were built in because they understood sinful human beings cannot be trusted with unlimited power. And so this Fourth Amendment was designed to protect us, we the citizens, from government going after us. Now, the other thing that many citizens believe is, well, you know, I really don't need to worry about it because I'm not a criminal, you know, I'm not doing anything wrong, so why should I care that they're looking at my library records and seeing all the books that I check out of the library, or they're rummaging through my financial records, which they've also given themselves permission to do every transaction we make with a check or with a credit card or a bank deposit, anything we do except cash, and of course they're planning a way to trace all cash too, but anything that we do at this point except cash transactions, they are watching. They have a record of every single transaction we make. What business do they have? Because the Fourth Amendment says here that, you know, it's the right of the people, a God-given right, to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. And certainly all your financial transactions are included in that. And yet, they have given themselves permission to do that in order to take complete control over every single person's life. And so we should never, never yield up our God-given rights for security. I believe it was Ben Franklin who said that anybody that does that, that gives up rights in order for safety, deserves neither their God-given rights nor safety. That's a terrible bargain. You lose, always lose in that transaction. Now, some of the decisions that have been made in the courts that have explained or given practical application to the Fourth Amendment are these. First, that there are extreme circumstances that require a warrant would not be immediately required, such as the police are pursuing a felon, the felon is fleeing, he goes into a house, so on. Or if there is a bona fide arrest, they've made an arrest and it's a lawful arrest and the search is related to that arrest, and such things as whenever an individual has a reasonable expectation of privacy, then this applies, the Fourth Amendment. But you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy if you're growing marijuana plants in your front yard, so to speak. And it's obvious to everybody that walks by on the sidewalk that that's what's happening in the front yard. Or you've got some criminal drugs that are laying on the dashboard of your car, things along those lines that the courts have determined. If you don't
hold
have
that thought right there, David, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and then Pastor Whitney is talking about these ideas, this whole idea of when it is reasonable to go ahead and doing a search without a warrant. So will you pick up the story there?
So they would say whenever there's no reasonable expectation of privacy, then obviously if the police see evidence of a crime that's in public view, then it's not required that they have a warrant. On the counterbalancing side, the courts have seen the abuse of our God-given Fourth Amendment rights by the police, and they've taken a way to check that by saying that evidence seized in violation of the Fourth Amendment cannot be used in court. So that if the police did not get a warrant, but they entered someone's home and they gathered evidence there, but because it was gathered without a warrant, therefore that evidence is inadmissible in court, unless, of course, that was a good faith error. They thought they had a warrant, or the warrant was somehow improperly executed. You know, in those finer situations, the judge may make a decision one way or the other, you know, just kind of making a personal decision there. But this exclusionary rule was designed to protect the citizens against police violating the Fourth Amendment, which indicates to us in the history of our country, it's been true that the police have pushed the envelope beyond what the Fourth Amendment very specifically restricts them from doing. And so the courts had to push back and say, wait a minute, it is unlawful for you to have gathered this evidence, therefore we're going to punish you as the police. We're going to not permit you to use this evidence in your case against this person that you've charged with a crime. So the courts adopted these exclusionary rules because they saw that it was necessary to make sure that the police respect the Fourth Amendment. And this Fourth Amendment limits government's authority to invade the individual citizen's person and property and papers without probable cause that they have committed a crime. And so all the things that are being done today, you know, the spy cameras that at least in my community, they're setting up just about at every intersection. Come to every red light, there's a spy camera. What are they doing? They're seeing where you are, at what time of day, and who's there with you in the car. What's the point?
In fact, it's really so interesting. If you're in your car and you have, say, a Globalstar positioning on your GM auto, they can listen to your conversations in the car. It is set up so they can listen to what you're saying. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, long-range planning having nothing to do with 911. And the same way with your cell phone, the same way with the telephone in your home. They can listen to what you're saying. Even when the cell phone is hung up, when the regular telephone is hung up, they have the ability, and many of even some of our computers, if they are on and connected to the Internet, connected to a telephone line, why they can actually listen to what you're saying. Why would they have a microphone there? Why, very simply, what is happening today has nothing to do with the terrorist attack. It has everything to do with bringing about the world of 1984 that George Orwell wrote about. There are people who have a different worldview. They do not believe in freedom. They hate freedom because they worship a different God. So pick the story up there, David.
And again, many people would say, well, I'm not worried about any of this because, after all, I'm not a criminal. I'm not going out to rob and steal and kill, and I'm not doing anything wrong. But what we need to realize is that we are now under a enormous mountain of bureaucratic legislative laws that control the minutest aspects of our life. I mean, I had a friend who, when he ran for the legislature, went down to the law library with the experts in our state who know the law better than anybody else. And he asked them, can you tell me how many laws a citizen of the state of Maryland is subject to? How many laws are they supposed to know? Because we know that you go into a court and you say, wait a minute, I didn't know that this was a law. Ignorance of the law is no excuse, is what we're told. Okay, so you need to know. And they could not tell him. And he asked, is it 1,000? Is it 100,000? Is it 1,000,000? They said, oh, no, it's more than that. Millions of laws. In fact, if you just took one segment of the regulations on our life and say, IRS code, and you were to spend a lifetime studying it, you still couldn't master all the things that you were supposed to know, all the bureaucratic and legislative regulations that are supposed to govern every aspect of your life, which means probably all of us are breaking some law or other, some regulation or some bureaucratic issue, and we're flushing too much water down our toilet, and we're breaking some law that says you can only flush X amount of water down your toilet.
That may sound absurd, but if you really read the World Bank Water Plan and our Sustainable Development Syllabus, they want, I think, to limit everybody to the use of 10 gallons of water a day for drinking, toilets for washing, things of that sort. Why would anybody do it that? Well, they claim we're running out of water. Just like we're running out of air, we're running out of oil, we're running out of everything. There are too many people. We're just going to have to regulate every aspect of human endeavor. And you say, that's crazy talk. Yes, it is. But unfortunately, we have some very vicious and terrible people behind the scenes today. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Pastor David Whitney. David, pick up the story there.
And so we need these Fourth Amendment rights. Every citizen needs to be secure from the government going after them for whatever minuscule or crazy bureaucratic thing that has been issued by some level of government that controls so many areas of your life. You know, one of the things I hear again and again, and these are sincere, godly Christians who believe that we really live in a free country. They say, boy, isn't it wonderful? God's blessed us with freedom. Well, yes, God blessed us with freedom, but our government has stolen that freedom from us, and we're not a free country. We're regulated and controlled, and when I ran for office here for the state legislature in Maryland this past fall, it was interesting to talk to people door to door and hear what they had to say, and people agreed. We're not only overtaxed, we are over-regulated to such a ridiculous extent, and yet people still believe we're free. They've been successfully duped into believing the chains that are around their wrists and ankles are bracelets and not chains at all. We are not free. We are as regulated and controlled as the communist system in China or Russia are examples of that kind of extreme control. And you try to do things, try to change something on your property, and you'll find those zoning laws are coming crashing down on your head. Or so many ways that we are regulated.
Try disciplining your children, giving them a good spanking when they really need it. And of course, my goodness, they'll come take the children away from you. They may put you in prison for doing something of that sort. And people find this so difficult to believe. Then we wonder why so many of our children don't have any discipline at all. And then they go out and they commit a crime, and they're horrified when suddenly they end up in prison. Why do you think that we have the highest level per capita of prisoners in our prisons anywhere in the world? We have, proportionally, per 100,000, we have far more people in our prisons than they have in communist China today. In communist China, why, they have slave labor there. The people get 50 to 75 cents an hour. In our prisons, they get paid 11 cents an hour. But you're not ever told about this. You're not told how. I mean, they use, for instance, fear of prison rape as a means of keeping people in line. We accept this. It's part and parcel of going to prison. We make jokes about it. Haven't you heard them joke about it on the programs? What sort of a country allows people to be men to be raped in prison? What sort of country have we really become? We'll be back in just a moment with Pastor David Whitney. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Pastor David Whitney. And before we go on, David, I really want you to tell our listeners about the Institute of the Constitution. I want to tell them how they can get in touch with you, how they could get the kit that you offer so that they could begin to teach others about the Constitution, because most Americans have never been taught about the Constitution. They have removed the teaching from our schools and from our colleges, from our law schools, and most of our legislators who swear to uphold the Constitution have no idea what it says, and yet it is the only protection we have from tyranny. We, those people who support the Constitution, are the patriots, and the people who violate the Constitution are traitors to our nation. When you accept public office, why, and I have in the past, swear to uphold the Constitution and defend it against all enemies, foreign and domestic. We have in Washington, D.C., in the Congress and the Senate, enemies, domestic enemies of the Constitution, are passing legislation they know is unconstitutional, but of course that's how they get reelected, and nobody's going to hold them to be irresponsible because, after all, everybody's doing it. Go ahead, David.
Well, the only way we can turn the situation around here in America, the only way we can restore that constitutional republic that was bequeathed to us by our founders, is to understand the Constitution and its foundation, which is the Declaration of Independence, and its application, which is the Bill of Rights. And so we put together what we call a host kit, because we know that individuals would find it pretty intimidating with the idea of, well, I'm going to teach the Constitution. Well, you don't have to teach it. You put in a DVD or a VHS and 12 lectures walk through the history, the Christian heritage, the worldview of our founders, which was a biblical worldview of law and government, gives a thorough understanding of that backdrop as well as then a working knowledge of the Declaration, of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and then the subsequent amendments. And these pieces are not insignificant. I know a lot of people think, well, you know, I'm not a lawyer. I don't need to know all that. Yes, you do. As a citizen, the only way we're going to preserve our God-given rights, the only way we're going to be able to restore our republic is if millions of citizens rise up and throw the people out of power who are currently traitors and are acting treasonously, violating the Constitution. But you can't know that they're acting treasonously unless you know the Constitution, unless you know the law that they are violating, which is exactly why it's not taught in law school or high schools or colleges anymore, because those in power don't want the people to know. They don't want the people to rise up and restore the republic. Otherwise, they will have their plans thwarted. So our plan is in every town and every Bible-believing church and every family that's committed as patriots, they would understand these principles. And that's why we've crafted this host kit. It's designed as a turnkey method that anybody can take this with any group of people and communicate these truths and help educate Americans to take action with this information. And our host kit can be ordered online. If you want to go to our website, we have a web store, and that website is iotconline.com. iotconline.com, standing for Institute on the Constitution, iotconline.com. Or if you want to order by our toll-free number, you can call us, and our toll-free number is 866-730-9796. That toll-free number again is 866-730-9796. Dr. Stan, we're particularly encouraged as in 50 states now there's classes being held. We have an exciting opportunity here in Maryland. The legislative session starts tomorrow, Wednesday. And a week from tomorrow, we're going to begin teaching the Institute on the Constitution to legislators, to delegates and senators, to their staff here in Annapolis. And just an exciting opportunity because these people need to know what the law is that should govern every single piece of legislation they vote on. They need to understand the worldview. They need to understand what the law is and the supreme law of the land. Any law made in violation of this supreme law of the land is null and void. And so we're excited about the opportunity to teach our own state legislatures, and we hope to see this spread across the country, that if we can reach the people in power, and if they will not change their ways, remove them from power, and put people in who are committed to understanding the Constitution, we can restore a republic. Along those same lines, I ran for office this past fall, and I encourage people, once they have taken and graduated from our course, Institute on the Constitution, they are better qualified to serve in the state and the federal government than 90-plus percent of the people that are there on both state and federal level who do not understand the purpose of government and do not and are not specifically committed to restoring the republic. They're better equipped because they understand the truth of what our founders bequeathed to us. So we encourage all of your listeners to get a host kit and start by educating your own family and then move to taking this to your church. Every church in America that believes the Bible should be teaching this. And I encourage people who say to me, you know, I don't think my pastor would go for this. He's really, I think this would sound to him as too political. This is not the mission of the church. I tell him, please give my phone number to your pastor. Give my toll-free phone number and have your pastor call me. I will talk to him, pastor to pastor, and tell him why it's essential that he train his congregation to be Christian citizens. As a matter of fact, Jesus has even commanded him to do so. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. You can't render to Caesar in America what you owe to our civil government. You cannot do it unless you know the Declaration, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. You cannot function as a Christian citizen in this land. So anyway, that's that's what we're about, and we really encourage people to get involved, and it's something that everyone can do.
Can I just mention that in all 50 states now, there are or have been these classes now, and people all across America are doing this. The other side, the enemies of freedom, are the globalists who would enslave our people, and believe me, there are not that many of them, but they're very well organized, and some of the wealthiest men in America who believe that we should have a ruling aristocracy, and this is what it's really all about, is return to a feudalistic system. They're frightened to death that the people are beginning to wake up. But the Institute of the Constitution is doing an amazing job, and you're never going to hear about it on the media, and you're never going to hear about it from Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, or Brian Williams, or the other people who are, well, the finest commentators that money could buy. Why? Because they're paid fabulous sums of money not to reveal what's going on, but to conceal what's going on from the American people. But I think it's so exciting now. In every state, you have or you have had these programs going on.
And understanding these things is the first step, and the second step is to take action. And we want to take action with knowledge, and that's the only way we can restore the republic. Well, we discussed the Fourth Amendment and how critically important it is. And if, perchance, they have found evidence on you that they say you've committed a crime and you're charged with a crime, the Fifth Amendment protects you in that process of being charged with a crime, and each step of the way, there's levels of protection for you as the citizen because you are innocent until proven guilty, at least in God's eyes, and certainly in English common law, and in the history of America that was true, and it's being undermined and destroyed today, but that is what is the truth. And so the Fifth Amendment begins by talking about if there's a capital crime you're charged with, or an infamous crime you're charged with. A capital crime would be one that is punishable by capital punishment, death. Our founders believed in capital punishment. They did not think that putting someone to death for a crime they committed was cruel and unusual punishment. No, right here in the Fifth Amendment, it states that you can be charged with a capital crime and therefore punished with capital punishment. But if you are charged with a capital crime, you have this protection, the protection of a grand jury. Most people don't understand what a grand jury is or what its design is to function as. It is to be a shield to protect you from an overzealous prosecutorial system. The grand jury is average citizens, common citizens. It's just to be a cross section of the citizenry of the area, and the grand jury is to look at the evidence that the government has gathered against you. And the grand jury, independently of the prosecutor, is supposed to make a decision looking at that evidence and even doing an investigation of their own. The grand jury is given the power to investigate whatever is brought before them. They are to investigate to determine if the state has enough evidence that determines there is probable cause that you have committed a crime and therefore ought to go to trial. So the grand jury's job is to decide whether you go to trial or you don't go to trial based upon the evidence presented to them and any independent investigation they choose to conduct. No grand jury are told that today. They're told the prosecutor is going to give you this information. You look at the information the prosecutor gives you, and you make your decision based solely upon the information the prosecutor gives you. Now, what's the prosecutor going to give them? The prosecutor going to give them a fair and balanced set of evidence? No, the prosecutor is going to give him what the prosecutor wants. He wants a whole lot of convictions so that he looks like a tough prosecutor and can get reelected and promoted and what have you. No, the grand jury is supposed to function independently of the prosecutor, not to be a rubber stamp doing whatever the prosecutor wants them to do. They have the power to investigate whatever they choose to investigate. You know, the prosecutor gives him a stack of evidence and says, Look at this big stack of evidence here. Obviously, this guy's guilty and should go to trial. Just give me a rubber stamp. Give me an indictment, and we'll shuffle this off to the court. And they should not ever do that. If you serve on a grand jury, please don't do that. Please love your neighbor as yourself. Do unto your neighbor what you would want to have done to you. That is, that you don't just listen to the prosecutor. You say, oh, okay, the prosecutor says this, 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 and this about this citizen. let's do some investigating on our own, independent of the prosecutor, to find out if they've cooked the evidence or if they've only presented part of the picture to us. Let's do some investigating on our own. Sad to say, most grand juries don't do that. Why? Because they haven't been educated as to what the function of a grand jury is. Instead, they've got the prosecutor or his whole office telling them what their job is. One of our programs at Institute on the Constitution is to teach people what the function of a grand jury and a petit jury is, and perhaps when we're finished walking through the Constitution here, we can walk through that course as well, because it's very important that American citizens take the powers of the jury that they serve on seriously, educate their fellow jurors about what their role is in protecting the citizens from an overzealous prosecutor, an overzealous government, that their rights are defended. You see, the grand jury is supposed to be a buffer between the citizen and the state, in order that no one should go through the expense and the trauma and the jeopardy of a trial unless a grand jury of common citizens determines the evidence shows there's probable cause they've committed a crime and this ought to go to trial. You need to remember that the grand jury is never determining guilt or innocence. No, never. So when oftentimes you hear in the news, grand jury has handed down an indictment and it's pronounced in a way in which you're led to believe, obviously if a grand jury has handed down an indictment, this person's guilty, let's just take them to the electric chair today. No, that's not what a grand jury does. The grand jury indictment is only stating, we find that there's enough evidence to take this to trial. There's enough evidence, we haven't determined whether the person's guilty or innocent, we're just saying, okay, the civil government has enough evidence, and this ought to proceed to trial. So don't ever hear the word a person's been indicted by grand jury and therefore assume, they're guilty. Obviously they're guilty. Grand jury indictment. No, it's only to say there's enough facts that this body, the grand jury, has found that determines that the government can proceed with a trial. Now, alongside the protection that a grand jury provides is the protection against double jeopardy. That is, you cannot be tried. This is a Fifth Amendment protection. You cannot be tried twice by the same jurisdiction for the same offense. And the intention of our founders, because they saw how King George abused this, that if he tried you in one jurisdiction with one jury, and, they declared that you were innocent, that wasn't good enough. They were going to try you again in another jurisdiction for the same crime, and again in another, until they finally found a jury that would say, okay, the guy's guilty. Or by the time you've gone through a number of trials, you're probably bankrupt and you've been ruined and your business is gone because you can't do your work and be dragged into court all the time. And they realize that, no, we need to protect against the government abuse of the judicial system, and you should only be charged once and tried once. And if you're found innocent, then you are innocent and you should be set free and not charged again for that same set of crime, the same set of facts and so on. So
but I say that we see this though, how they get around this. We'll have the state try these police officers to see if they're guilty, and the jury finds them innocent. Well, then we'll have the federal government try these same police officers again, and we're going to, of course, make sure that this time, why, of course, they're convicted. And this is how the system works, and we've gotten away from this idea. That people are innocent until proven guilty. The government decides you're guilty, they're going to come after you again and again in one jurisdiction, and then, of course, in the federal jurisdiction. So see how they circumvent these ideas. And this is the problem we have today. There are people in high positions who have a different view. They think they know what's best for us common folks.
And unless we return to, and again, we the people, if we understand these principles, understand what the Fifth Amendment says, we can hold those who are violating these principles accountable. I mean, quite often judges are up for re-election, or they have to stand after so many years to be reaffirmed in their office if they're in an appointed position. And so ultimately there's some accountability there, and we need to know whether the judges are allowing double jeopardy to come into their courtroom, whether they're keeping the Fifth Amendment and the Fourth Amendment protections for the citizens, because if they're not, they need to be removed. All across our country, we have these violations taking place, and Most Americans are unaware of it and unaware that it's against the law. We've gotten this idea in our head, and it's a false idea, that whatever the government does is lawful. So they pass a piece of legislation, well, that's the law of the land. Or you know, a judge issues an opinion, well, that's the law of the land, and so on. The truth of the matter is, the supreme law of our land is the United States Constitution, which incorporates the Declaration as its foundation and the Bill of Rights as its application and the subsequent amendments. And any law made on a federal level or a state level and any action that violates this Constitution is not lawful, it's illegal, it's law-breaking.
Now, David, we're just about out of time. I want you to get your website and your telephone number out one more time.
Yes, our website with a web store is iotconline.com. That's iotconline.com. And our toll-free number where you can call and order is 866-730-9796. That toll-free number is 866-730-9796.
And, of course, remember what Thomas Paine said. He said, all societies are good, but government at its very best is a necessary evil. At its worst, it's tyranny. Well, David, why don't you, I've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program. Why don't you go ahead?
Well, if we get this idea in our mind that the law, the supreme law of the land is the Constitution, again, this is why it's so essential for every citizen to know and have a working knowledge of the Constitution, the Declaration, the Bill of Rights, because it is your job as a citizen to check tyranny. When the government violates this Constitution, we need to hold them accountable. Nobody else is going to do it. They certainly are not going to hold themselves accountable. No, they want more power. They want to get away with breaking the law, and we must not let them do that. And so a piece of legislation can pass, and if it's in violation of the Constitution, it is unlawful. It's not the law of the land. And it, and again, this covers a lot larger circle of people than just those who are legislators or those who are in the executive branch. It covers the police, and it certainly covers the military. They take an oath to uphold the Constitution, and if they don't know the Constitution, they may walk in and violate somebody's Fourth Amendment rights, and they don't know it. They were told this is what they're supposed to do. This is their job as a policeman. But if they know the Constitution, they can resist unlawful actions on the part of the police force, unlawful actions on the part of the army. And so if the law-abiding citizens of our country know the law and begin to hold the feet to the fire of those who are in positions of power in all three branches of government and take their rightful place as jurors on a grand jury and a petit jury and begin to take back our country from the law breakers, there's hope for America.
Amen to that.
Our constitutional republic.
And I think it's so vitally important, ladies and gentlemen, that you out there in the listening audience get involved. You could make a great deal of difference, but you've got to have the courage to do it. Because, you know, right now you say, well, it's not going to affect me. Ladies and gentlemen, remember what happened to Solzhenitsyn. What was Solzhenitsyn's crime? Why, he wrote a letter and he criticized the government. And, of course, he was taken to the gulag for 8 years. You say that couldn't happen in America? Well, the president has said you're either with us or against us. And believe me, they're keeping dossiers on every single citizen. They've reconstituted those Japanese prison camps for $38 million. Why do you think they're doing that? Why do you think they're suddenly actually appropriated $385 million to build new detention camps, gave it to Halliburton? We're in real trouble. David Whitney, thank you so very much for being with us.
God bless you, Dr. Stan. Thank you for your great work.
And you just keep up trying to get people to understand we are on the side of law and order. We believe in the Constitution. God bless you.
God bless you, too.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, the Constitution is the foundation of our freedom here in America, and it was based upon God's law. It was based upon the concept that if people could be governed by God, they could be free. And those who will not be ruled by God will certainly be ruled by tyrants. And that's why they took God and prayer and the Ten Commandments out of our schools. If you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it, you need to read it. You need to get the DVD or the video that goes with that, get the, all three along with the tape. You can get the Brotherhood of Darkness special. Understand what the problem is. We're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Just 2 weeks ago, why the Congress, in their wisdom, appropriated $38 million to refurbish those Japanese concentration camps, which are out in the middle of the wilderness, but they said, we've just got to get those concentration camps out there in the middle of the arid area, where it gets 120 in the summer and down to 20 below in the winter, and that's where we put innocent Japanese during the Second World War. We put them there, 120,000 of them. Was anybody ever punished? Were any of them guilty? Oh, why did we put them there? Why, they were the enemy. It's sort of like the Muslims today. We've come up with a new word, Islamofascist. They're preparing us for a war with the Muslim world. They're building new concentration camps in America. If you doubt that, go on your internet and Google in Halliburton. $385 million detention camps. You'll read all about it. You want to find out about the why they're refurbishing the Japanese concentration camps. They tell us, oh, we want to refurbish those camps so that nobody will ever forget what a terrible thing it was to put Americans in concentration camps. Well, if that's true, then why are they building new concentration camps? You need to get our material on concentration camps. We have a 4-tape set. We have a concentration camp special. You'll see the videos. And with it, of course, you'll get some documentation from the military on how they're going to handle civilian inmates in these concentration camps. This is not imaginary. It's real. You need to get our 4-tape set on the Military Commissions Act. You need to understand we're involved in a spiritual battle. And God is going to bring terrible punishment on this nation. Our leaders are planning on taking us to war, expanding the war in the Middle East. Why do you think that we're suddenly going to put more troops into Iraq? Why do you think that the John Stennis carrier group is moving into the Persian Gulf? And the Boxer, of course, attack force is moving in there with its contingent of ships. And the Eisenhower strike force is already there. Ladies and gentlemen, we're moving to expand the war. Why would we do that? The American people don't want it. Why? Because there's another agenda. Because there's a group of people who run America who have no allegiance to this nation. And they realize the only way they'll bring about their world government is to have another major confrontation and a horrible war. And out of the horror of that war, people will say, we just got to have a world government. Now, if you'd like, of course, to know more about what's going on, go to my website, RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. And pull down my August, September, October, and November newsletters, and soon the December letter will be up there. Get them and read them and copy them and get them in other people's hands. All the documentation is there. Your job is not to become informed and then to inform others. Let them understand we do have a secret government. There are secret societies. Their goal is the destruction of the sovereignty of our nation and molding us into a one world order. In addition, I just want to mention that we do carry emergency food supplies. If you'd like a food catalog, if you'd like to get a big Berkey so that you can have water in case there's an emergency, if you'd like to be able to let in health supplies, all of these are available. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And certainly we'll be glad to send you the emergency food catalog, a health catalog, our regular catalog. We will even send you a free newsletter. But understand that behind everything going on are powerful spiritual forces. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. We're involved in the spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. And you're either going to be involved or you're going to be, well, we'll be back in shortly. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Christian civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and of course we ordinarily welcome your calls from out across America, but please don't call in unless we specifically ask for them. I want to remind all of our listeners that starting next Monday, our shortwave frequencies will change, and of course, the afternoon program will be 9.480, and of course, on the East Coast, that's 6 to 8 in the evening, but here in the West Coast, it's 3 to 5 in the afternoon, but in the East Coast, it will be 6 to 8, and then the evening program, which is the program you're listening to now, will switch to 5.755 megahertz. That's 5.755 megahertz. You may already be on them. We'd like to know if you're getting good reception on the new frequencies. We think hopefully it'll work out very, very well. Under any circumstances, our special guest this evening is Bill Sardi, and we're talking certainly with him about health issues. Bill is a health journalist, and he actually does research, and certainly one of the most knowledgeable people we have on so many of these issues that the average doctor doesn't have the time to research. The doctor's taking care of patients, and there's so much material and conflicting material. Fortunately, Bill certainly goes through this, and of course he writes articles. You'll find them on the internet. His articles appeared in very prestigious medical journals, even though he himself is not a physician. People recognize, of course, his value of his analysis, and we're very fortunate to have him with us here tonight. Good evening, Bill. How are you?
Good evening.
Why don't you go ahead and pick up the story?
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about some men. I know I like to talk about science and studies, and one of the things I do like is biography, but these are short biographies. They're actually little stories about some men. A couple of them we know, and couple we don't, and it starts with the story of Moses. Now, we know in the Bible records that Moses lived 120 years, fasted 40 days and nights. Said Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eye was not dim, nor his natural force abated. Deuteronomy 34:7. Means he had great eyesight. His vigor was with him to his dying day. And we do know that his fasting is what is attention-grabbing here. He was with the Lord 40 days and nights, did neither eat bread nor drink water, and he wrote upon the tables the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. And I think fasting is a good way to prepare for things, and it's man's a way of cleansing himself before he sets himself for a task. But nonetheless, he does this, lives 120 years. The modern term for this, we've talked about it before, is calorie restriction. And, of course, this is the term now that everybody unequivocally believes calorie restriction would be the way. We could limit our calories. We would live far longer and healthier than ever. And it's interesting because as we look at this, there was actually a study done at McGill University in Canada. And what they did is they gave little animals three different kinds of diets, an ad libitum diet, a calorie-restricted diet where there was 40% less calories. That's pretty restricted. And a 40% calorie-restricted diet with added minerals, added metallic minerals, iron, copper, and so on. And when they went to look at the plaque and the deposits in the brain of these animals that would lead them to premature aging and disease, it was the calorie-restricted diet plus the metallic minerals that created the greatest trouble, the most amount of plaque in the brain. But it wasn't the one that was the diet restricted.
We'll be back here in just a moment. All right, Bill, go ahead and pick up the story.
Well, what we're trying to say there is that it wasn't the calories that were restricted that caused the brain disease in these animals. It was, or excuse me, it wasn't the calorie restriction that brought about any benefit to them whatsoever. It was the significant issue was the minerals in there. And if they had more metallic minerals in their diet, they were worse. If they had less, it was they were, of course, had less plaque in their brain. It had nothing to do with calories. They gave the animals an ad libitum diet where they could eat at will. They gave them the calorie-restricted diet. The amount of plaque in their brain was about the same. It wasn't anything significantly different. But when you added the metallic minerals, that's when you got the brain in trouble. And so they're making a lot about calorie restriction these days, and it's true, it works, but the overriding principle that's underlying all this is really calcium and iron that overloads in our body. Now, that puts us up against two major industries in the United States, the dairy industry and the meat industry, because the meat is where we get highly absorbable sources of iron, and the dairy industry is highly absorbable sources of calcium. We just saw the federal government this week announce more benefits for adding more calcium to your diet. This is all in league with, of course, the dairy industry. So I make you aware that the fasting and the things that go on seem to be a way to really control the minerals, these metallic minerals and calcium, the calcifications that come along in our body as we get a little bit older. It's interesting to watch women control their iron through menstruation, and then as soon as menstruation ceases, they're not dumping their iron once a month. 80% of the iron's in the bloodstream, so as women lose a little blood in the monthly flow, why then they're controlling their iron just like men would if they did bloodletting or donated blood periodically. And so as soon as women lose that, along comes osteoporosis. Well, osteoporosis has nothing to do with iron. We thought that had to do something with calcium because we're losing the calcium. But it has to do with an iron overloaded state. I won't go into all the science behind it, but suffice to say that as your body accumulates more iron, then you begin to lose the calcium out of the bone, particularly for women. So this is a complicated process, but it actually goes on. So nonetheless, we're talking about super longevity tonight, and we know that...
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Bill. Okay, fine. Well, Bill has certainly been talking about the values of calorie restriction, but the major value of the calorie restriction was the fact that you weren't getting a lot of minerals. It really had nothing... certainly this was the major thing. It wasn't the fact you were taking less calories in, but if you could limit the intake of iron and of calcium, then you were going to be far healthier. And yet, of course, we're told, oh, my goodness, you've got to drink a lot of milk, you know, and you've got to eat a lot of meat. But, of course, the meat gives you the iron, the milk gives you the calcium, and large amounts of these minerals are deleterious to our health as we grow older. They're important when we're young and growing, but as we get older, of course, they really do a great deal of harm. So you picked the idea there, Bill.
Well, you know, we're hearing so many messages, it seems always so confusing to us. Why do people get old? I used to sit on a hill at summer camp, going to a Christian summer camp, and I used to go up to summer camp, look at the stars and the shooting stars and all the things in the sky, and I used to think about living and dying and all the things that you think about when you're growing up, and I used to wonder, why do we grow old? Somebody must know. There must be a reason. And the actual reason behind all this is actually that we actually rust and we calcify and become statues. That's how we grow old. We don't actually grow old in our first 20 years of life or so. Now they look in the back of the eye, there's little deposits that start forming all throughout our body, little garbage deposits called lipofuscin. And it doesn't start appearing till about the second decade of life. That's interesting. Why wouldn't it occur in the first 20 years? Well, because these little deposits are starting from calcium and iron, excess accumulation of iron and calcium. And of course, when we're growing, all of the iron goes to red blood cells, all the calcium goes to the bones. So as we're growing, there really is no aging. aging begins around age 18 or thereafter when we're fully grown. And that's when we run into trouble, and that's when we begin to accumulate calcium and iron. Now, women escape this. They donate the calcium and the iron to their babies. They're sometimes perpetually anemic, pale, tired, weak, but they outlive men by 5 to 8 years, sometimes much longer. And women, if they have early onset menopause or an early hysterectomy, then their mortality rate doubles or triples, depending on when they have it, especially before the age of 40. As women reach menopause, then thereafter in postmenopause, their risk for heart disease goes up by 360%. It's all because they've lost the control of calcium and iron. And so we see that if we would knock down the amount of food we eat in our adult years, this is the calorie restriction or fasting idea, certainly it's going to be hard to do when we're growing because we're pretty well famished as children all the time. Children need to take naps, they need to eat snacks between meals because of all the requirements of growth. And of course, as we go on, why then we have this accumulation. In midlife, a woman at age 40 will have half of the iron overload that a man will have. Men start accumulating iron about one excess milligram per day of life from age 18 on. So at about age 40, men will have double the iron load of a female and double the rates of diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and rates of infection, since bacteria, viruses, and funguses all depend on iron for their growth. So you can see here why men don't live as long. Now, if men can find a way to push the red meat away and to drink more green tea or do more things that have berries and cherries and grapes and those kind of things, those are iron-controlling molecules in those foods, particularly bran. There's a component in bran called IP6 you can buy. It actually is an extract of rice bran in the health food stores that chelates calcium and iron from your body and can clean out your arteries and your kidneys and your liver and your brain of all these accumulations and problems that you've been doing over the years. In fact, at my website at Knowledge of Health, we do have the advice to undergo a rice bran cleanse from time to time because it's the most profound thing you can do to improve your health as an adult. It's not for children. It's not for fertile females, but certainly be wise after you've had all this accumulation of these minerals. And from time to time, it's a great idea. So a rice bran cleanse, a lot of times in natural medicine, people hear, well, I want to do a cleanse. Well, the best cleanse you can do is with rice bran extract. It'll take any parasite out. It'll take any of the bacteria, viruses, and funguses because they won't get enough iron for their growth. And it inhibits onboard tumors that might be there and so on. So
I think it's really so interesting that, you know, a couple of hundred years ago, bleeding was a standard treatment. In fact, you know, when I was growing up, every barber shop had this sign out in front. It was basically a red and white a tube, you know, a stripes, red and white stripes. But that was this, and years ago, a couple of hundred years ago, the barbers were the bleeders. And certainly we know that George Washington, many people were bled on a regular basis because what they were really doing was getting rid of their iron at that time. And a couple hundred years ago, they knew that if you were bled occasionally, it would actually help your health. Isn't that true?
Well, this goes way back even to Bible times. It's not mentioned in the Bible, but in Bible times they did do a lot of bloodletting. And for children, it's inappropriate. And, of course, they didn't know how to stop it with what George Washington. They just overdid it. But it was true that if you had a way of getting the iron out, you might get well. This was observed thousands of years ago. Now, they didn't know it was iron at the time, but by bloodletting. Now, if you think this is archaic, it's actually being practiced at Harvard and some of the better medical schools as treatment for iron overload, for fatty liver, for cancer. The major medical centers still do quite a bit of this. It's a particular problem for men who overconsume alcohol and red meat. If you got those two combined together. You're having a steak and a beer every night or frequently, and you're going to have a lot of iron coming in because alcohol increases the absorption of iron that goes to our liver. 35% of Americans simply have fatty liver disease. And it's just iron deposits in the liver that then harden the fats that are there, and this is how we get high cholesterol as well, because cholesterol is made in the liver. If you can imagine, the incidence of fatty liver disease in Japan is far less, except in the cities where they drink a lot of alcohol. The rural areas of Japan, and this is actually a stunning thing to consider, by age 50, and moving on between age 50 and 70, a third of Americans will develop little aging spots in the back of their eye that we call retinal drusen. Now, drusen are little yellow spots. You can see them. It's an indication your retina is getting weak. It's calcified. It's got too much iron. It can't let the garbage deposits out because of the calcifications, and they build up in your retina, and you can actually see them there. And that's about a third of Americans between the age of 50 and 70 develop these little deposits. An eye doctor can see them on a retina exam. Now, in Japan, up until recently, the incidence of retinal drusen in Japan was stunningly zero. They didn't have any of this because they don't have a lot of grazing land for cattle, for beef, nor for cows for milk. And so they have a very sparse diet. They do import beef and certainly dairy, but they don't have much of it. And so because of its sparse supply in their diet, you see the Japanese are living by far the longest. And so it's quite stunning when you can look inside the body. The eye is one of the few organs, practically the only internal organ, we can actually examine from the outside. And you don't see the retinal drusen in the rural Japanese that still eat the traditional diet, largely vegetarian foods and so on. So it's calcium and iron that drives all this. And you won't see, this is the definition of youth, is that you have a place for the calcium and the iron to go, so to make red blood cells and to make bones. So it's an interesting thing to see that there's a little premature aging disease called progeria. And very young little children, they're bald, they get cataracts, they look old way before their time. They never grow over 3 feet tall. Well, if you don't grow tall enough, there's not enough red blood cells and bones for to take up the calcium and the iron. And, of course, then what is the characteristic of progeria? These kids calcify and overload with iron because they didn't grow tall enough. It's kind of an interesting phenomenon when we put it all together, try to explain it all. Now, there's a shortcut that recently came up to our attention about aging and super longevity, and that had to do with not fasting, not calorie restriction, but actually a genetic connection. And this was developed by Dr. David Sinclair in a discovery also with researchers at MIT. And they found that there is a gene in the body that's turned on, the sirtuin-1 DNA repair survival gene, that's switched on when we can't find enough food. And, of course, now there's a way to switch it on without depriving ourselves with food. It's called a red wine molecule called resveratrol. And so I want to get in, I think a break's coming up, but I want to get into an interesting man's life in China who lived over 1,200 years ago and how he found the shortcut to long life. And it's a rather interesting story.
All right, well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Bill Sardi. And I think the first thing is that there's so much to health that you're not going to learn through regular channels. A lot I never learned in medical school. You know, we always used to think you wanted a lot of iron because that was going to make you big and strong and healthy. Well, it's fine when you're young, but when you get older, why, of course, it really is deleterious. Well, Bill, go right ahead with the story.
Well, the story goes on about a man named He Xiao Wu. He Xiao Wu. He Xiao Wu lived about 800 A.D., and he was a man who, at age 58, according to the records, he was a man that had no children, could not father any children, and being impotent and despondent, he was given some advice about a tall vine that was growing, and he took that vine and then took the root and kept shaving it and made a powder out of it and then put it into a wine that he drank, a typical homemade wine. And wine, by fermentation, would concentrate and drag out the contents out of the root and then, of course, give him whatever medicinal value. They were used to doing this in the Chinese traditions, and this is what he did. Well, what he happened upon was a little root called giant knotweed. Now, it's a little different version than giant knotweed. There's a couple different versions of it out, but today we get another source of resveratrol, the red wine molecule, comes from the giant knotweed plant in Asia. It's commonly used in dietary supplements today as the source of resveratrol. And the story about He Xiao Wu is that he quickly fathered a child and then fathered five more. This was all after the age of 58, and lived 130 years, according to the record, and actually started to grow dark hair again. Keep that in mind, because we're going to get back to that in just a moment. You know, a lot of folks with gray hair would like to figure out how to get the dark hair back again, and it plays a part in our story tonight. So He Xiao Wu actually was eating a little herbal remedy that you can find in health food stores called Fo Tea. But Fo Tea hardly has any resveratrol in it because they just don't know how to preserve it and concentrate it. What He Xiao Wu did was to take and put it into, of course, a wine, which then, by alcohol extraction, concentrated its ingredients and then was able to readily use it right away. And he was making it fresh, and this is the way that he got these molecules. And then, of course, now I want to fast forward in time to a man who lived in Italy, and this man, Luigi Cornaro is his name, and he lived about 1466 with his birth date in Padua, Italy. But he's the combination of Moses, the fasting, and He Xiao Wu, who practiced the herbal remedy or the shortcut to aging that was more recently found to be resveratrol, a molecule in red wine grapes. So along comes Luigi Cornaro in the Middle Ages. And living in Italy, he is a man who at age 35 was called a drunkard and a glutton, and he had many aches and pains, and his doctors told him to do something about this and to lead a temperate life. And from that day on, for some reason, in a rather rigid manner, he measured out his food, no more than 12 ounces of food, no more than 14 ounces of red wine, ladies and gentlemen, only in Italian. Would think that three glasses of red wine was temperance. With a little bit of a giggle, he was getting the resveratrol molecule, and he was getting the, of course, the calorie restriction.
Hold up, we'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Bill was simply telling us about this Chinese gentleman who lived some 1,200 years ago, he was in his 50s and had never had any children, and he started actually using this Chinese root and putting it into wine. It was really basically a resveratrol type of compound, and suddenly he had a wife had a child, and then he had five more children after he was 50 years of age, and he lived up in well over 100. And then Bill was telling us about a man who lived in the 1400s who used marked calorie restriction. He only used about 12 grams of food a day, and certainly 14 grams of wine, and of course he was, the wine gave him the resveratrol. The calorie restriction gave him the advantages that we have from really restricting our calories, which seems to actually cause people to live longer in many ways and healthier. So pick the story up from there.
Well, Luigi Cornaro goes on to meticulously write treatises. You can find these on the internet. His books, you can read them. You can still buy one of his books that's been translated from Italian into English. And he goes on to explain at age 31 and 51 and 71 and at age 91, he lives 102 years. He has 11 grandchildren. At age 91, he says, I can still jump up on a horse. I can run up a flight of steps. I still sing songs. Look, I'm writing. He was writing thoughts and certainly had all of his mental faculties, all the physical faculties, not sick a day. And all he did was measure out carefully and limit his food and his wine. But he was drinking the wine. And, of course, he was doing the combination of the calorie restriction and the resveratrol molecule, which mimics the calorie restriction. Luigi Cornaro dies in a rocking chair, never a day of suffering. He just died, like Moses did, full strength. Not weak of eyesight or weak in any way. He just died one day. Today, Americans are dying in chronic disease and living for 10 or 20 years and bankrupting their families and going through so much suffering and over-medicated with 7 or 8 medications. And this is the way we die. We're not dying like Moses did. We're not dying like Luigi Cornaro did. Or He Xiao Wu in China, as I give you the accounts of these stories, and we begin to piece together why these men lived so long and how they were able to make accounts of their longevity. And we move on up through the historical ladder, and we go to a little town of Rosetto, Pennsylvania. Now, this was in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, and Rosetto, Pennsylvania was a little village with Italian immigrants. And for some profound reason, this made it into the Journal of the American Medical Association, the men who lived in that place, Rosetto, Pennsylvania, were virtually immune from heart attacks. In fact, there were no heart attacks whatsoever for more than 2 decades. They came, they investigated, they took blood samples, they looked at everything these men did, and they missed it. They missed the big picture, because this was really what we later on called the French paradox. These men, these hard-working Italian men who ate a lot of pasta, worked very hard, but they were importing their precious wine from Italy and drinking about 3 glasses a day, 3 to 5 glasses a day. And it was that precious wine that was made in the traditional manner that was giving these men this unusual health quality. Now, they missed it at the time. They brought in sociologists. All they could do is to say it was close family ties. They had no idea what it was. But we can piece it together now in retrospect, because these men were getting the resveratrol molecule out of their wine. It was 1992, and it was a Sunday night, and the 60 Minutes television show came on, and they talked about the French paradox. And it was, a doctor from France, Serge Renaud, and he got on, and he had a book, The French Paradox, and he got on to say that the French have higher cholesterol levels, eat more calories, have fattier foods, and yet have 1/3 the cardiovascular mortality death rate. Their rate of dying, 91 per 100,000. Ours in the United States, 240 per 100,000, almost 3 times difference. It's an amazing fact that it's not their diet, it's their secret weapon, their shortcut, their red wine, which contains the resveratrol. Of course, as we move on in this story, we'll tell you a little more now how we update this into our modern times now.
Well, of course, really it's been sort of fascinating as I've looked over Bill's shoulder over the last few years. A great deal of work has been done actually at Harvard University by Dr. David Sinclair there, trying to find out how you could get people to live longer and healthier. And of course, well, Bill will tell you a fascinating story. I hope you're as fascinated by it as I have been over the last several years. Well, Bill, go right ahead there.
Well, it's researchers at the National Institutes on Aging who've made us aware that the resveratrol in red wine is a molecular mimic for calorie restriction. In other words, instead of depriving ourselves of food, that we can actually just get that molecule. And we would live exceptionally long and healthy. Now the big question is, what are we going to do with this sudden surprise that mankind had no idea was going to arrive? It wasn't on anybody's wish list. What are we going to do with this profound discovery? Actually, it's only a few Americans who have begun to adopt this idea. It's really as old as the Bible. I can't say that it isn't really actually a Bible idea. But fasting and red wine are all Bible ideas, certainly. And the idea of this certainly didn't escape the people in Bible times, that we needed to cut back on our food volume once we were fully grown, and that we needed to find a healthy way of living long. And now we're faced with the prospect. In the year 1900, the life expectancy was about 50 years, 55 years. We're now up to about 75 to 80 years, and now would you like to think that you're sitting at home on your 75th birthday and you have 50 more years ahead of you? Yes, that's exactly what they're telling us this resveratrol molecule could do for us and give us good health. It would increase our lifespan and our health span. It virtually eradicates the plaque from the brain. Now, as we get older, we have this beta-amyloid plaque buildup. We begin to lose our memory. Charlton Heston is affected by it now. We saw it in Ronald Reagan and so many others, maybe loved ones that you have. And yet this resveratrol molecule, virtually in very, very small doses, nanogram concentration, not milligrams, not micrograms, which is a thousandth of that, but a nanogram, a millionth of a milligram concentration, is able to work in the brain to eradicate this beta-amyloid plaque. Now, one of the researchers who did the investigations on this was in New York, and he said, please, just wait. Don't run out there and buy the resveratrol supplements, because I'll invent a better molecule, and then you can start taking it. What gall this man had while we see our loved ones suffering and getting older and in this way. Maybe we don't need to.
Hold that thought for just a moment. We'll be right back with Bill Soddy. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, our guest this evening is Bill Soddy. And before we go on, Bill, I want you, Chris, to get your website out, and I want you to get your number if you'd like to get it out, so people could, of course, get in touch with you and certainly get the great information that you have.
Well, so everyone knows, I am commercially involved in that red wine resveratrol pill idea. I wrote a book about it and happened to be at Harvard and happened to play a role in inventing one of those little red wine pills. But that's not the point of the story. This evening, you can find the stories about Moses and He Shall Woo and Luigi Cornaro and the men who lived in Rosetto, Pennsylvania, and David Sinclair at Harvard. It'll all soon arrive at knowledgeofhealth.com, because we have a special report up there, the historical viewpoint of super longevity. Did any men way in the past live super long and super healthy? Apparently they did. And the running thread that goes through all those is either calorie restriction or the discovery by these people of the red wine molecule called resveratrol. So apparently these are not stories of mythology. These are not things that are accounts that are really outside what we now understand. That man's top, it looks like, can live 120 years. That seems to be the limit. The Bible talks about that, about 120 years. It's exactly what the scientific experts say. We have a chance in our lifetime now, regardless of what age we are, to take advantage of this wonderful discovery. Now, what they're trying to do right now, because we do get a lot of people saying, I don't want to live that long because I simply don't want to be a burden on others. I, I don't want to be senile and in a wheelchair. None of us want that. The promise of resveratrol is it does keep the nervous system intact. We can see that it reverses the little lipofuscin aging pigments that occur throughout the body from age 20 on. It has already reversed the drusen, the macular drusen that we see in the back of the retina in a couple of people taking red wine pills. And quite remarkably, remember when I told you that He Xiao Wu in 800 AD was a man who regained and got his dark hair back? In fact, the name He Xiao Wu, they changed his name to that because it means man with dark hair. And, of course, now we have some people who've been taking red wine pills, and they get these little stories back to me on the phone and the Internet. They've got about 7 or 8 people who had gray hair. It's all turned dark again. They've got these dark patches coming back and looking much younger. It hasn't worked for me, so don't run to the store for red wine pills. But I'll have to say that remarkably, there's something going on here. Something that is historical, and we will find it out more in time. We might need stronger doses and so on. The red wine pills, I was interviewed in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, National Public Radio, and that the quality of the red wine pills on the market today are pretty shabby. So being really of poor quality, you might need to bone up on this a little bit. You can find out more at my website, knowledgeofhealth.com, knowledgeofhealth.com. But I know a lot of people are interested, which wine do you drink, Bill? Well, I'm not much of a wine drinker. The Bible says to be careful about that. Even talks about mingled wine, diluting the wine so we won't become inebriated. And for all of us, probably our wine drinking is best done at home, because even one glass of wine will impair our driving ability. This has been proven over and over again. And certainly the health benefits only go to the modest wine drinker, and this is certainly only a couple of glass, 5-ounce glasses of wine a day. We don't want to give license to anybody to overconsume alcohol. Nonetheless, certainly the warnings are there, but at the same time, even the Bible talks about health benefits of wine. And so they even knew in Bible times how to preserve the resveratrol in red wine, because if you don't put it in a dark bottle and cap it, and if the cork is not perfectly tight and the air gets in there, it'll turn to vinegar. Now, actually, the Romans actually took clay jars, these amphora jars, and were able to seal them in an airtight fashion, and then take the clay jars and put them on boats and ship it to Egypt, and they would open one up, and if it was wine, it was wine. If it had turned to vinegar, they wouldn't pay for it. So they knew how to keep it airtight. What they would do is, those amphora jars look like they're long, they look like a bomb, actually. And they tilt them on their side, and this gets the solids off the bottom, and then the clay cap swells up, and then there's an escaping gas hole. There's a little hole in the clay jar and allows the escaping fermentation gases out. And once that's done, the art of that was to cap it with clay and know how to seal it in an airtight manner. And that's what you have to do with red wine pills. They have to be airtight and sealed and preserving that resveratrol molecule, and then you've got the secret of red wine like we do today. So it's a very interesting thing. If you're a wine drinker, then you would want to get resveratrol. It's not labeled. You don't know whether it has resveratrol in it. But your best way of finding it might be by getting Pinot Noir wine. It might be getting it from a northern area like Oregon, Washington, Burgundy region of France. The more moist areas make more resveratrol in the grape. It's a protection against fungus. So the more moist areas have more funguses, and so therefore more resveratrol. So certainly don't want to be a great advisor about wine here, because obviously 40% of Americans never even think of touching alcohol. Another 20 or 30% drink very mildly. So the idea is for them probably they'd be amenable to thinking about the red wine pill, which has no alcohol, no calories, no preservatives, and so on. So the question is, what will Americans do with this information? Will they wait for more science? Wait for their doctor to tell? We don't know what. we don't know. We do know that if we can get Americans to live just 7 more healthy years, we will save Medicare from going bankrupt. You see, aging is age-related disease, chronic disease. The blood pressure and the diabetes, all these are related to age. And so if we can push aging back, we can push the first day of the onset of any of those diseases back by 7 years. That's the goal. A lot of us can do a lot better than that. We can live 7 more healthy years. We will save our own pocketbook. We will live much happier and healthier. And, of course, we will save our society from the crushing load of having millions of Americans with Alzheimer's and diseases that we simply don't have the money to pay for.
You know, Bill, certainly I'm at an age where many of the doctors who worked with me, you know, even much younger than I am, and now have Alzheimer's disease. And how tragic it is, you know, these people I've laughed with and cried with and worked with, and we, you know, did everything we could to practice good medicine during those years. And to see, you know, some of these people with Alzheimer's disease and this slowly progressive disease, it just destroys the mind to the point where you don't recognize people, and then eventually you can't even look after yourself. And the thought that, you know, certainly we could prevent this with this is really such an exciting thing. I've been taking resveratrol now for how long? Probably 4 years or so. How long have you had it on the market?
Well, it's going into its third year, almost the end of the third year.
All right. Well, I've been taking it ever since you first started talking
right.
about it.
It is remarkably interesting. I don't want to get tonight's program to be a commercial for anything. I just want to try and make this as real as I can for people. That there is something miraculous that God, a molecule that God put on this planet, they can't invent a better molecule, a better drug than this. And there's nothing that resveratrol doesn't do. So think about what I just said. There's nothing it cannot do. It's an anti-inflammatory, controls blood pressure, cholesterol. It's an antifungal, an antiviral, an antibacterial. It is an anti-estrogen. It works to build your bones. It's an antidepressant. You can just go on and on.
I think people have to understand how it works. It's like a switch, and there are about 600 genes, isn't it, Bill? That
right.
Basically, what it does, it either turns these on or off. And, of course, the genes manufacture proteins. That's the function.
Correct.
And this is a master gene that controls all the other genes.
Correct. And it's turning on one gene, which then controls many others, this sirtuin-1 gene, as well as so many other pathways. But resveratrol is actually perceived by the body as something it doesn't want. And therefore, it turns on all alert defenses. And so it thinks that this is like starvation. And so, therefore, it preconditions the body against any insult that's coming. Well, when you have a stroke or a heart attack, your body makes an enzyme to control iron molecules. I was telling you earlier about iron and calcium being the real problems in our body by losing control of it. We need calcium, we need iron to make red blood cells in our bones and so on. But it gets out of control. And as soon as we have a heart attack or stroke, the brain will start making a little enzyme called heme oxygenase, H-E-M-E oxygenase. It's a way of controlling the iron molecules to limit the damage from those events. Resveratrol turns the switch on to make heme oxygenase before you have the stroke or the heart attack. This is its miracle. So that the brain and the heart are on alert to repair themselves and to protect against this before you have any of those events. We think that the French are having strokes and heart attacks and not even knowing they happen. They're protected from this. And that's exactly what it is. You see, resveratrol is actually seen by the body as something that is bad. And so all of the alerted defenses in the body are turned on. And so it doesn't harm us in any way. But it mimics something that's harmful. And this is how it works. And it upregulates the ability for the brain or all of the rest of the cells in your body to clean themselves out. There's little lysosomes that make enzymes that clean your cell out. What's very interesting is the cells in our skin and our gut lining and so on, they're rapidly replaced. But the cells in our brain, our eyes, and our heart cannot be rapidly replaced. If they were, we'd have tremendous problems. Our memory would disappear quickly because we can't be replacing our brain cells rapidly. Our memory would be erased. Same in our eyes. If we were replacing those cells, we would have a lot of debris from the old cells going, and we'd actually have debris in our vision. We couldn't see out. Our eye would not be clear. So, and the heart, because it's pumping all the time, we can't just replace the muscle fibers with new ones all the time so rapidly. So the heart, the brain, and the eyes have slow replacement cells. They replace themselves extremely slowly. You now see some people that have been in comas for 10, 12, 15 years, and you start to see them come out because it takes that long for them to grow new brain cells. We used to be told the brain learned how to use sections of the brain that weren't damaged. No, they're actually showing that it's regrowing brain cells, but it takes that long. Well, this is a problem. Once we've lost our brain cells, or the cells in the back of our eye due to macular degeneration, or whatever, they're very difficult to replace. And they don't rapidly turn back over. So once we've lost them, you probably lost them for good, because you're probably going to die before you could ever get them replaced. It takes years to get them back. And so this is the problem we have in the retina. And so many of these cells right now in your body, if you're 40, 50, 60 years old, they're already marginally operating. They're filled with this lipofuscin garbage material, which just keeps accumulating and accumulating until the cell dies off. And if you're losing cells in the brain, in the eye, in the heart, then they're going to be very difficult to ever get back. And this is our problem, certainly, for the brain. We can lose 70% of our brain cells before we start having symptoms. So we don't even know this is going on. And then all of a sudden we've got Alzheimer's, same thing in the eye. So we start losing our vision. We didn't perceive that we were losing our vision. In fact, this macular degeneration problem comes along in one eye first, and the visual field of the other good eye crosses it. So we can't even see that we're losing our vision unless we happen to close one eye at a time. And a little eye test for you now once in a while would be to close one eye and look at reading material or something, see if you see any blind spots or weak areas, because then you know what's coming on. But once you've got it, there's no treatment for macular degeneration. A third of Americans are going to end up with this, with the signs of it. And you can see it by these drusen spots at the back of the eye. Now, we need to do a more conclusive study, but this stuff never disappears, and we've got a couple of people who've been taking the red wine pill, and on retinal photography that the doctors do, confirmed that the retinal drusen was erased, completely disappeared. So there's great hope for this, that maybe this would be a remedy for this. We'll find it out over time. But
well, aren't you actually going to, isn't somebody going to be doing a study on that?
That's right. In Baltimore, there's a study going to start here soon. The profound part of all this, and I know it's hard for Christian people to fathom this, is that if we had twin brothers and they lived next door to each other, and one of them exercised every day, had a great diet, took a lot of vitamin pills, and the other brother did none of those things and drank red wine, well, the profound research shows that the wine drinker will outlive the other brother. You see, there's a powerful molecule in there. And we have disparate information now. Red wine only provides, at best, 1 milligram of the resveratrol molecule per glass. But in the supplements, when they did the study recently with mice, they had to use quite a few more milligrams to get the effect. But in doing the mouse study, they did use this resveratrol molecule. Now, the mice were on a 60% fat calorie diet. They engorged them with fat. They developed fatty liver. 35% of Americans have a fatty liver condition. And then they used the resveratrol, and it reversed and erased the fatty liver condition. These animals their motor function, balance, and coordination was maintained, and they, of course, lived 31% longer, and more so, they didn't show any of the effects of a high-calorie diet, so high-fat diet. So this was a remarkable part of a recent mouse study that was recently, the story carried around the world, started in the New York Times. So,
and that was actually done back at Harvard, wasn't it?
That's correct. And the National Institutes of Aging, where they had the mouse lab.
Okay, fine. Well, I mean, these things are really exciting. Carried over, hopefully they're going to carry over into human beings. Everything would tend to indicate that it will. And if that indeed is the case, why, of course, this is one of the greatest medical breakthroughs of all time. And that's why the New York Times and the Washington Post within the last, New York Times and the Wall Street Journal have been carrying articles about it. Go right ahead, Bill. You've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Of course, the question is, will they allow all this to happen? You're talking about one molecule replacing virtually every drug that you now take or your loved ones take or you may ever take in the future. If one medicine, natural medicine, can, what Dr. Serge Renaud reported is that the red wine had an effect that it didn't change the cholesterol numbers, it didn't change your blood pressure, it just changed the mortality. It has an anti-adhesion effect, so that if a cancer cell is roaming by, it can't stick to an artery, that means that cancer can't spread, the immune system will get it first. If a blood cell is coming by, it can't stick, so therefore you can't have blood clots, heart attacks, and strokes. If a tumor cell is coming by, it can't spread, as we said. So you can't get the calcium to stick. These calcifications can't occur. So the red wine has anti-adhesion factors in it. There's literally nothing that this molecule cannot do. Now, there's another molecule in rice bran we talked about, sometimes called IP6. In the health food stores, I talked about a rice bran cleanse. It's described at the Knowledge of Health website, knowledgeofhealth.com. That's combined in one of the red wine pills that I helped develop, is to combine both of those to try and control the calcium and the iron in your body. They're the two, what they call the malignant spirits of aging, is that as we get older, we rust out and we calcify. And it's not cholesterol that's getting you older. We're all on the wrong street here. And you might want to read the stories that we're going to have posted at knowledgeofhealth.com. Go back over those accounts of those stories, all the way from Moses to He Xiao Wu in China, and then Luigi Cornaro in Italy, and then the men of Rosetto, Pennsylvania, and finally the people in France now living so long, 45 to 65% longer in the wine-growing districts, the people in Okinawa who are literally calorie-restricting, living very long. These are all pockets of where the 100-year-old centenarians now live. And, of course, the discoveries of David Sinclair at Harvard. So it makes a wonderful historical review. Yes, people that lived way in the past certainly may have lived super long and super healthy. It all seems very plausible. The evidence for this has been here. The problem is mankind never paid attention to it. Luigi Cornaro even wrote it all down, a wonderful Christian man, who begged others to follow in his steps as the discoveries of health that he had made for a living. And you might want to read his book about the temper.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening has been Bill Sardi. Bill, did you have any sort of telephone number you'd like to get out there?
Well, not this evening. Nobody's manning a telephone, but if you go to Knowledge of Health, they'll be able to knowledgeofhealth.com. And you can find a lot of this information there. Hopefully you'll use it to your good health. And I think we're just on the precipice of a wonderful discovery for mankind if the public can understand it. And if they really allow this to happen, you're talking about virtually deep-sixing every medication we've got down at the pharmacy.
Well, thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure, and I learn something every time we have you on. God bless you, Bill. We'll talk to you later.
Good night.
Good night. All right, fine. Well, I hope our listeners have enjoyed the program, and I will tell you that, I mean, I've been taking it ever since Bill put this on the market, and I still have gray hair, but my wife says that the streak of gray that she had seems to be going. Coincidence? Well, you can't certainly run a series on one person, but I will tell you that I'm believe that certainly knowing the studies, and we have many of these scientific studies, and we've read them very carefully, this truly is a miraculous thing. Because this one gene in resveratrol, this one molecule actually, turns on and off about 600 genes. Truly one of the most amazing stories of all time. Well, once again, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that you need to do to help you. Incidentally, I would mention that we do carry this iodorol. We had a program last week on iodine, and having read the material on this from a number of sources, I'm convinced it's helpful. So if you're interested in actually getting more information on iodorol, why, we'd be glad to send you the package insert, or give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927, if you're interested in getting an iodine supplement. Certainly we hope that many of you will want to get Dr. Russell Blaylock's excellent book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. If you have somebody in your family that has cancer, why, you really need to get the book, Natural Strategies for Cancer Patients. Natural Strategies for Cancer Patients, and the videos or DVDs put out by our good friend Dr. Lorraine Day. Diseases don't just happen. Cancer doesn't scare me anymore. And the other material we carry by Dr. Lorraine Day, it's all listed in our catalog, and you can go up on our internet site at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to know about the statin drugs and how they're being abused and how they're one of the greatest scams of all time that is frankly hazardous to the health of the American people, we have a book on statins, inexpensive. We have a four-tape set on statin drugs. If you'd like to know about magnesium, and most Americans are deficient in magnesium as they are deficient in iodine because they've intentionally taken the iodine out of our about 45% of our salt, and you don't know that. They've taken it out of our bread, they've taken it out of our milk, and they've created an iodine deficiency. And why would they do that? Well, then they put the fluoride in the water, and they spray it on our vegetables, and they put it in the things that we drink. And fluoride, of course, competes with the iodine for position in your thyroid. And then we have so many people hypothyroid today, but don't you worry, we have them all on Armour Thyroid. Ladies and gentlemen, there's so much to health that you really don't know about. Let me suggest, certainly, our material on fluoride. It's called The Hidden Agenda, The Talk. And we have actually three DVDs on fluoride. We have the book, The Fluoride Deception. We have a syllabus on fluoride. And we'll be doing the same thing with iodine here as soon as I have a time. You need to get our material on the vaccinations, on the influenza vaccine that they're giving to pregnant women in the first trimester. There's a wonderful video we have with Dr. Ayub simply on the influenza shots. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. Look at the material we have. Get it, read it, study it, and help us get the word out across America. A great deal is being done that is harmful to our health. They're poisoning us with NutraSweet. They're poisonous with fluoride, they're poisonous with mercury, they're poisonous with vaccinations. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for our leaders and ministers, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.